We're going to move the clock forward to 2010. You're still the underdog. You've still got obstacles. You're going to have to raise money even when the money people don't want to give it to you. You're going to have to persuade the greater part of the state. But you're the governor. You've managed well. And all you need to do is tell the people about it from one end of this state to the other.
Governor David Paterson officially announcing his candidacy for re-election over the weekend, one day after the breathlessly anticipated New York Times article about the governor was finally published on Friday. Here is more of Paterson taking it to all of the local papers.
This governor is not going to quit in trying to reduce spending to reduce property taxes. This governor is not going to quit fighting for new jobs in clean energy, high tech, biotech, and advanced manufacturing. And this governor is not going to quit because tabloid newspapers print rumors and innuendo and lies all the time, waving the banner of a newspaper that could have cleared up the facts and chose not to do so.
Governor Paterson, and maybe never before, has an article in the Times made front page news in the tabloids for days before its publication, with rumors of things that might be in the piece reported as news. Maybe never has the Times public editor or ombudsman needed to defend the paper for not revealing in advance what would not be in an article that was not yet published. And maybe never did a sitting governor do a publicity tour on national television and radio to take credit for the fact that he did not do the things that had not been reported about him. Someone called Tim Burton. It was politics through the looking glass in the already hyper-weird world of Albany. But is the article, now that it's out, the bombshell that everyone was waiting for? In its non-sensational way, was it maybe even worse than the false rumors about it made it sound? Danny Hakim is the New York Times Albany bureau chief and the lead reporter on really the two Paterson articles published last week that kind of go hand in hand. Danny, welcome back to WNYC.
Thank you for having me.
And let's talk about the governor and the content of your piece first, and then I do want to go back and talk a little bit about the wacky pressure cooker around you and the Times before it came out. The most damning thing to my eye in the piece is that the governor seems to have almost no supporters. Tell us how you look to get people to praise his record in office and what you came up with.
Well, the governor's people, you know, asked us to call sort of a list of people. I mean, and that's that's fairly standard. I mean, we like to give people a chance to, you know, have supporters talk on their behalf, especially when we're doing a tough piece. So they did provide us a list of some supporters. I think what was surprising in this case is that several of those people wouldn't return our calls or talk to us on the record. So that's definitely not a great sign.
And the closest you could come was a Buffalo banker named Robert Wilmers, who had also been a Paterson appointee on the Empire State Development Corporation. He praised the governor's tough language about the budget, but when you asked whether Paterson is an effective governor, Wilmer said, quote, "I think he's a gentleman who wants to do the right thing. Beyond that, I don't keep score." I mean, Danny, ouch. That's something for a supporter who is referred by the governor to actually say.
Right. I think any time, you know, if that's the person you're sort of serving up to be your defender and booster, I think, again, that's not a great sign. And certainly, I mean, something that's been striking on the governor's, this sort of little tour he's done to announce his election campaign, there's really almost no officials out there from the Democratic Party. I mean, the Democratic leadership is almost entirely absent on this campaign trail. So,
Although, as the Times reported today, the governor did get a bigger crowd yesterday in Buffalo than his campaign expected.
Yeah,
the report
true,
was
sure.
They planned for 50 and they got 200. Does that tell you anything?
Well, I mean, I think that's certainly a good sign. And I don't think that the crowd in Hempstead where he started was certainly not so bad. It was about 400 people or so. So that I think that was good. I think he did get booed pretty loudly at a hockey game when he dropped the puck at a hockey game in Syracuse, but hockey crowds can be pretty tough anyway. So I don't know if they'd give any politician a good a good welcome.
But somehow I'm not sure the NHL crowd is his base or whatever the hockey game was. But he also says he'll roll out some higher profile endorsements this week, David Dinkins included. Anyone else who you know of?
Well, I think one person I would guess would probably, I think Charlie Rangel, one would hope would be supportive. I mean, he certainly has been. I think the chairman of the Manhattan Democratic Party, Keith Wright, has been supportive in the past. I'm not saying I know that he'll come out with an endorsement or anything like that, but, you know, I think there will be some people that'll be supportive. But I think in the first week of your election bid, to not have, you know, other elected officials standing with you, it's sort of a sign of where he is right now.
All of those would come from his former district from when he was in the Senate. If you talk about Dinkins and Wright and Rangel, they're all from Harlem. You also raised questions in the article about how engaged Patterson is at what level of detail. You quote former Economic Development Commissioner Dan Gunderson, who said Governor Spitzer was very engaged in content with him, but he couldn't even get an appointment with Patterson. 12 separate requests for an appointment over a 100-day period after Patterson took office and Gunderson finally just resigned. Is that a pattern of disengagement that you found?
Yeah, very, very much so. I mean, obviously, we talked to, you know, a great number of officials, both current and former officials, who just said that the governor just doesn't have much interaction with commissioners or agency heads. He's just not very engaged in the business of running the state. Whereas former Governor Spitzer was something of a micromanager. He was intensely involved. You know, that's not to say that a governor has to be a micromanager involved in all the details, but you'd like to think he could find some time on the schedule for the for a major economic development official. But, you know, I mean, Gunderson basically ran the whole upstate economic development program.
And you cite former and current aides who say this governor is less interested and less curious about how various state agencies are doing. But what state agencies besides the development one can you cite by name? I only ask because the governor talks a lot about education. He talks a lot about health. He talks a lot about the budget. He seems interested in transportation. He talks about the MTA. So one could argue that he is very engaged with the biggest things that are going on in the state and maybe doesn't have time for every agency and has to pick and choose the things that he gets most personally involved with.
Sure. Well, I would say that there are regular briefings, you know, where commissioners are present, you know, conference calls. And there have been attempts in the past to get the governor to at least just listen in on these briefings, and they just haven't been successful. Sometimes they're either audio briefings or video briefings, and those haven't been successful. So I think there's a concern among some officials that he just doesn't interface with commissioners across the board, that he just sort of leaves it to his top couple of aides to basically do the business of running the state.
Danny Hakim, New York Times, Albany Bureau Chief. My guest on WNYC after his two long-awaited articles last week about Governor Patterson. And the headline angle on Friday was the governor being remote from the most seasoned people around him and increasingly reliant on some inexperienced people who he trusts. The worst of that seemed to come right at the end of the article when you profiled his Washington lobbyist, Gabrielle Turner, who had little experience. And you say within weeks of her appointment last year, an experienced aide down there, Veronica Sullivan, had resigned. She had been Chuck Schumer's and Anthony Weiner's chief of staff. But you don't quite say Patterson is replacing competent people with incompetent people. Are you making that charge?
Well, I think, initially they wanted Turner to run the entire office. And I think there is a question there. I mean, she had, in the last 15 years prior, she had 2 weeks of political experience as a volunteer on the Obama campaign. So I think you could, you know, one could ask the question, is this the kind of person that you want running or even in a prominent role in the Washington, D.C. office? She's now a deputy director. Someone with so little experience, so little recent experience, certainly, that is an incredibly important office for the state. I mean, it handles all these sort of outreach to the Obama administration, the interfacing with the congressional delegation, especially at a time when we're dealing with all the stimulus aid. It's just a very important office. Mm-hmm. So I think most people would want a seasoned person in there.
Though, again, trying to be as fair to the governor as I can possibly be, I'm not sure that you even attempt to make a case that these inexperienced people, and you also wrote the whole separate article about his very close aide, David Johnson, who rose up from being his intern and his driver a decade ago.
Right.
I don't think you're trying to make the case that these inexperienced people are doing a bad job. You don't really make that claim. You just compare their resumes to their predecessors. And Patterson could say, yes, I'm remote from the same old politics of Albany and the same old people, so I'm bringing in my people who are fresh and, you know, relying on people loyal to me and the people of New York, not staffers inherited from Spitzer or Pataki or the old boy network with their entrenched interests. So are you arguing in the article? Does anybody really even say that these folks are doing a bad job, Turner or Johnson?
Well, Turner has not been on the job all that long, so I mean it's just a matter of months, I believe, with her. I mean, I think with Johnson, I think I think there is a fair bit of concern within the administration that the governor has he's let sort of a very small group of aides almost insulate him from the rest of the administration. Johnson actually lives with him at the executive mansion, and so does. Excuse me. So does another another close aide, Clemmie Harris. And I think, you know, what you hear from a lot of aides in the administration is almost a lot of just sort of day to day business has to be routed through those two men. And so I think that is a concern just about that is a concern to a lot of administration officials. And I think you see those two gentlemen who have limited experience getting involved in a lot of different phases of government. From campaign issues to policy issues. And, you know, I think a lot of questions have been raised about Mr. Johnson. The Post even had a story over the weekend about him, a developer, paying for his trip down to Texas to see a Dallas Cowboys game. And the administration couldn't really come up with sort of a coherent account of, you know, if he paid the developer back. So I think there are definitely questions about his judgment. He's also he's being investigated. The administration is being investigated for his soliciting of tickets from the Yankees for the World Series, free tickets, which sort of raises questions about whether state laws were violated. Mm-hmm. There is a gift ban. So I think there's definitely, you know, there are legitimate questions of judgment there.
Danny Hakim, New York Times, Albany Bureau Chief with us. Danny, let's talk about the firestorm that preceded your article. For more than a week, the Post and the Daily News were screaming about rumors of sex and drug-related revelations that might be in the piece, none of which turned out to actually be in it. The governor went on Larry King Live and IMUS and other national media to deny he was doing what hadn't even been reported. The media was even on alert for the governor to resign the moment your story became public. It was crazy.
Right.
What was that period like for you?
Well, it was certainly a little odd. I mean, I think I certainly hadn't encountered something like that before. I think, you know, from my perspective, I'm just trying to do the job I'm doing, which is, you know, taking time to prepare a carefully reported piece. So, I don't think we can let sort of other news organizations dictate, you know, when we publish a story or what we publish, or, you know, we have to do what we have to do and take the time we think we need to publish a story.
And the governor himself argued during that interim, as we heard in the clip we played, that because your editor told him the article would not include sex and drug charges, that the paper should have gone public with just that much to quiet the speculation and quell the political damage that he said was being done to him based on things you weren't going to report anyway. How did you and your colleagues consider that request? How did that work?
Well, I think it's kind of unheard of for a paper to come out and comment on a story that hasn't even been published yet while it's still being reported. I mean, I don't think there's much precedent for that. We did put out a the paper did put out a brief blog post at some point, just sort of, you know, addressing the situation. I think it, you know, I think it, even if we were to say something, I think it would be difficult to figure out what one would say in that situation. I mean, some rumors are true and some aren't, and stay tuned. I mean, I don't...
If you said there was nothing about the governor's sexual life or anything involving drugs in the article, would that have breached journalistic standards?
I don't know. I don't know. I mean, again, it was such an unusual situation. And, I mean, obviously when you're reporting a story, you're looking, especially a profile of this length, you're looking at a whole lot of things, you know, so... and the story was really still being reported.
Mm-hmm. Did you investigate sex and drug rumors and conclude they were unfounded?
Well, I'm not going to talk about, you know, what I did look at and didn't look at and all that kind of thing. It was a long story. It took, you know, I think 3.5 weeks to put together, and I don't think that's an unreasonable amount of time for a story of that length. But I just don't think there's any, you know, anything to be gained from talking about what was left on the cutting room floor of a story like that.
Did you ever think the story you were developing could lead to the governor's resignation, as the Albany Press Corps was on standby for a couple of days?
No, well, when those stories started coming out, I was perplexed by them. I just didn't know where it was coming from. I thought they were kind of odd. No, I didn't. At the time when those stories came out, I thought they were overblown, for sure.
Were you aware at the time that the Albany Press Corps was on standby for the possible resignation of the governor based on anticipation of what would be in your report?
Well, I mean, when they started saying that, I was aware.
Yeah,
yeah, sure.
And what was the buzz in the Times newsroom about that?
Well, I don't, you know, I work up in Albany, so I'm, you know, I don't know if I can say what the buzz in the newsroom was. I mean, I think we were somewhat perplexed by what, you know, that other papers were spending this amount of time speculating about a story that hadn't even come out. It seemed fairly odd. I mean, look, this is an industry that has been shrinking. We've been losing a lot of reporters, even in the press room here in Albany. We've lost a fair amount of reporters. So I think to me, to spend so much time speculating about what another paper may or may not be working on just seems like kind of a waste of resources at this point in time in the industry.
Well, how did this idea get started about a salacious bombshell story? Did you or people on your team let something slip to your colleagues from other media? Hey, we're working on this big story about the governor, whoa, ho, ho, without saying what it was, anything like that?
Absolutely not. No, absolutely not. I mean, I think, look, Albany is the state capital is kind of a unusual place. I mean, rumors, it's sort of a hothouse for rumors and a lot of gossip. So, you know, obviously we were reporting a significant story. We had, you know, we had reporters from, or at least a reporter from outside the bureau working on the story. So I think, you know, that maybe gets people talking. I think maybe since the Spitzer story, people are more attuned to what we're doing. So, you know, I think there's probably a variety of factors. But no, it didn't come from anything, you know, that we said.
You didn't leak it. We have at least one listener on hold right now who wants to say he's outraged that the Times would leak something about a coming story to the Post. So you didn't do anything like that. that wouldn't happen.
No. No, that wouldn't happen.
Did it come from sources, people you had interviewed? Did you run this down? You must have been curious.
Well, you're asking me this question like I know the answer to it. I really don't know. I mean, I'm in some ways I'm as befuddled by it as you are. I mean, I don't know. I really don't know. I mean, I assume, like I said, when you're reporting a story like this, you're asking questions to sort of a range of people, and you know, I assume. You know, maybe some people started talking. Obviously, we're in an election year, so people are even more, you know, more likely to start talking and gossiping about something. So, you know, that is probably what generated, mm-hmm. you know, generated all the gossip.
We just have a minute left. Any lessons to be learned by you or your colleagues from this incident, in your opinion?
Well, I would hope people would, you know, I personally don't think it's, you know, a good use of resources to worry so much about what other news organizations are doing. Like I said, we're a dwindling industry in some ways, and I would just, you know, spend the time actually reporting on government or reporting on, you know, public institutions. I think that's probably a better way to spend time.
Got any more stories coming that we should know about?
I'm looking forward to writing about the budget again.
You know that it's been too exciting a time at Albany when somebody's looking forward to writing about the budget again. So we thank Danny Hakim, Albany Bureau Chief for the New York Times. Danny, thank you very, very much.
Thank you.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Coming up in just a minute, we will pick through some of the details of President Obama's own health reform plan just released at the top of this hour. Let's see what's in it.